Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to explore how eating whole grains leads to improvement in your gut and immune response. We're also going to take a look at least three different studies at three major universities, including the Cornell School of Medicine, about Crohn's disease and arthritis. They've discovered a bacteria that's causing it. Well, that means that we can get rid of that bacteria and replace it with a good bacteria. And also, University of Vienna in Austria, scientists explore how a prebiotic can deal with a lot of conditions, and it's as simple as mint. And then we'll look at how a gut bacteria can play a role in Alzheimer's disease from Lund University, that's in Sweden. And a common question I have all the time, people wanting to change their diets a little, Gary, are chicken and fish okay, or are they as unhealthy as red meat? I'll explore. A lot of kids are getting a lot of medical procedures today, and frequently they're using anesthesia to get those. Not good. I'll explain what anesthesia can do to a brain of a young child. And also, cancer is set to explode in the Latinos population. Why? And why? What can we do about it? And also, severe childhood obesity. That's where the kids are really overweight. It's mushrooming. According to University Baptist Medical Center, Wake Forest, what's it mean? How do we get there? And more studies on the healing power of cacao and living longer with time. Lots of good health information. Special commentary, Chris Hedges, The Elites Won't Save Us, from Toothdig. And also today, how the left killed the anti-war movement. Now, I'm talking about the corporate left. I'm not talking about the ideal left. I'm talking about those who are the corporate Democrats and corporate liberals, including on MSNBC. So I'll share that with you. And then, if time permits today, and I'm sure it will, scientists are predicting eugenic society right now. You've already seen it. You've seen IT revolution. You've seen the driverless car. Remember, they wouldn't be advertising it and showing it to you now if it weren't already ready now. It's when they decide to roll these things out. Well, what about the new humans? Don't think they've been working on them? Think again. And I'll explain what I know. So that's our show. We have a lot to share, and let's begin. First up, from Lund University, the gut bacteria that plays a role in Alzheimer's disease. Some new research from Lund University, that's L-U-N-D, has shown that intestinal bacteria can accelerate the development of Alzheimer's. Now, according to the researchers behind the study, the results open up the door to new opportunities for preventing and treating the disease. Why is this important? Because that's your gut, yet Alzheimer's is in your brain. Wrong. Your gut has a brain. There's 100 billion neurons in your gut. Your gut brain and your cranial brain work compatibly. And because our gut bacteria have a major impact upon how we feel through the interaction between the immune system, the intestinal mucosa, and our diet, the composition of the gut microbiota, which means the gut flora, is of great interest in the nature of disease. And by studying both the healthy and diseased, they're able to understand, what do you have there in the healthy and what do you have there in the disease? Are they the same or different? Well, turns out they're different. I remember the head of the Trafalgar Hospital, medical doctor, very fine person, came to me one day and he said, there's an interesting situation here. Do you believe that there is a difference in the bacteria in the gut of a sick and healthy person? I said, absolutely. He said, I remember a conversation we had about 5 years ago where you said that all health begins in the intestine. And at the time, I just thought that was nonsense. I didn't see any basis for that. But I'm beginning to appreciate that maybe there might be something to this. So I began with him to look at the people in Travalka Hospital who had different diseases and then compare them to people who did not, who were healthy. And I said the best people you could get would be natural hygienists, people who have a very pure diet, who eat lots of raw foods, organic. They don't have alcohol. They don't use sugars and preservatives and chemicals in their diet. So they would have, and they have a lot of probiotics in the diet. And at that time, nobody was talking about probiotics. Nobody. The only thing that had happened in the last 30 years involving probiotics was two very good books on miso and tofu and the fermentation process. And that was it. And those were mainly macrobiotics who were doing that. In any case, it was very clear when you examine the intestines of a person with what I would call autotoxemia, meaning sugars, pizzas, hot dogs, hamburgers, bacon, eggs, dairy, cheeses. The gut is frequently congested. The peristalsis doesn't work right. It goes very slow. There's lots of constipation. There's lots of fermentation and putrefaction, mainly from the animal proteins and the simple sugars and the fats. So you get bloating and gas and frequently, but not always, diarrhea or constipation. And constipation is an epidemic in our society. I mean, you've seen all the ads on television. Right now, there must be four different companies trying to get you to buy their drugs to help you with constipation when good fiber would do the job. In any case, there was an extreme amount of putrefying bacteria, as well as yeast overgrowth. And yeast itself is very smelly. Anyone who has yeast overgrowth, they just have this vile smell coming out of their bodies. But a healthy gut, just the opposite. It's just like night and day. If you look under a microscope, you'll see good bacteria from fruits and vegetables, from grains and legumes and nuts and seeds and juices. And it's a healthy motility, meaning that food's going through your intestine at a good rate so your body can digest and absorb it, eliminate it. And you don't have the bloating and the gas and all this. And you don't have things like ileitis, diverticulitis, colitis, spastic colon. So please understand that everything you consume will impact that gut. And from that gut bacteria, the rest of your body will either be in a healthy state or a disease state. And that's what this is showing. Because they showed what happens with the good bacteria and the bad bacteria. Now, adding on to that is a University of Colorado study. And this recent study showed that prebiotic fibers can help to protect beneficial gut bacteria and restore healthy sleep patterns after a stressful event. Well, most people have stress, and most people don't get a good night's sleep. So they kind of go hand in hand. More stressful you are, the less sleep you have. Well, there's two ways of dealing with it. One, you could take 1 to 3 milligrams of melatonin or 5-hydroxytryptophan. Both will help you sleep if you've had trouble and stay asleep throughout the night. Secondly, you can make sure you turn off all light in your room, put earplugs in, and keep all electromagnetic pulse things like cell phones and computers off and away from your head. And also, you could take just a few minutes, 5 or 10 minutes before you go to bed, and just sit and write down the things you want to resolve tomorrow that were not resolved today, who you're going to call, and just 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to say this. I did not like the way you spoke with me. It was not kind. I don't like the idea that I'm always responsible for your interest. I never see it reciprocated. And just anything that bothers you, you write it down. Now, what that does is it suddenly tricks the brain, because now your brain is saying, okay, I don't have to think about that now. I'm going to do that tomorrow. Now, I created this about 30 years ago when I found that I sleep very little. I don't even tell people I have a little sleep because they think it would be unhealthy, but for me, it's not. And And I just do all this every night. I just write everything down and go right to sleep. I mean, like instant. And I know it works for the people because they've given me feedback. But now we can add something else on that. Take your prebiotics. Beets, prebiotics. Yeah, a lot of different food are not probiotics, they're prebiotics. And the quality of the fibers help that. So, and that helps you deal with stress and creates good bacteria, which also creates good bacteria. And by the way, the best prebiotic in the world is breast milk. Of course, that's why one of the reasons that breastfeeding is so important, because it allows the baby to create good bacteria and also to get more sleep. For you, asparagus, legumes, lentils in the legume family, you'd have split peas and lentils of all types, soybeans. Oatmeal is another good one as well. That'll all make you better able to sleep. A good study showed in Australia showed that fruits and vegetables supplement in your diet your body's natural ability to lower your cholesterol and turn off inflammation. Quote, fruit and vegetable concentrate supplementation to older obese adults can help reduce cholesterol levels and markers of systemic inflammation, especially with those with high inflammation levels. Well, who would that be? Well, how about arthritis, bursitis? How about heart disease, cancers, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, macular degeneration, cataracts, diabetes? All of those, you have high levels of inflammation. So in this case, when people were getting their fruits and vegetables every day, berries, and they did this for 8 weeks versus a placebo, major improvements in their cholesterol. Their cholesterol went down, especially the LDL, the bad cholesterol, and there was a reduction in cardiovascular risk, which is heart disease. So fruits and vegetables, once again, help us live a longer life. And for those traveling to areas where you're liable to get malaria from mosquitoes, something new, researchers at Lund University in Sweden found that horseradish is a natural repellent. So eat horseradish when you're in these climates. That's good. And real quick, a few more. I'm always asked a lot of questions about diet, needless to say. So what we're asked is, gee whiz, I'm almost a vegetarian. Almost there, they'll say, yeah, I gave up the hard red meat, but what about chicken, lamb? What about fish? And the reality is, first, they all are sentient creatures. They all feel pain, including fish. And they all are part of our industrial farming complex. So when you can say no to all of them, you're doing a great deal of good for your own health, because there's never been a study published that I can find that shows that eating animal proteins prevents or reverses the aging process or diseases associated with heart disease, cancer, diabetes, etc. But eating these do increase your risk of disease. And the only difference is in the fish oils. But you can get the same oils that you would get from fish in plants like avocado and walnuts and hemp. And by the way, I believe that as a society, we should be reintroducing hemp on a major level for industrial use, like in clothing. And we could eliminate tearing down a lot of trees for paper if we did grow hemp in its place. And also, once you go on a plant-based diet completely, your intestine speeds up. You have less constipation, less colorectal cancer, less prostate cancer, less breast cancer, less high blood pressure, less heart disease, less dying of heart disease. And if you do it right, you're going to add about 6 to 9 years onto your existing lifespan, even if you did nothing else. So that's my answer there. And to the Latino community, according to Science Daily, the Latino population, quote, of the United States is expected to triple in the near future, and like over the next 30 years. And along with that growth, says University of Illinois, is you're going to have a rise in cancers. And Why? Because of the American diet. And, quote, it's just going to explode. It's really a train wreck waiting to happen. And we're not doing enough to anticipate women's needs. Even right now, we are not doing a good job of providing services for these women. So in many of the Latino countries, the diet is actually healthy, as is much of the lifestyle. But when people migrate to the United States and you start consuming a lot of fat food and French fries and the deep fried foods and the sugar and the soft drinks, and you're not exercising, you're at risk of cancer. So I will be doing a major health support group through the summer for different groups, including Latinos and African Americans, to see if we can't reverse obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and other conditions through diet. And finally, there is a study from Wake Forest University that says, quote, the rates of severe childhood obesity have tripled in the last 25 years, putting many children at risk of diabetes and heart disease. Quote, children are not only becoming obese, but becoming severely obese, which means their overall health is at risk. And I've seen it. You've seen it. Everyone's seen it. The question is, why aren't we dealing with it? So my next documentary up, after the current one, is going to be on saving our children with the choices that are important in their lives. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Al Jarreau, he passed away over the weekend. Great in many different fields, and rhythm and blues and jazz, pop. There are things we can do. We can become first aware of who the profiteers are who drive our foreign policy. Who are the people with power behind the scenes? Who are the smart people who figured out who serves their interest, how to buy their loyalty, and then how to control the media, the legislative process? Here are, starting today, I'm going to give you 10 companies that profit the most from war. Let's begin. So these are all good statistics to know about. Why? Because anytime you hear a country being demonized, almost always there's going to be a whole lot of lobbyists in Washington who are sending out letters and experts from think tanks to convince us that these people represent a real immediate or existential threat to the United States. They do not. Russia does not. Iran does not. And China does not. Yet you wouldn't know that by the major media or the people who are talking heads. Behind those people, who funds the think tanks? Who funds the foundations? The major corporate interest. Who control those people? Well, there's a big group of people who are up front, probably 200,000 to 300,000. There's a tiny group behind them. This is the deep state. These are the people that control these industries, own the large blocks of stock in them, control the board of directors, yet it's never in their name. United Technologies, in just one recent year, their sales, $58.2 billion. How many people do they employ? 199,900. They're mainly in aircraft, electronics, and engines. That means that they've got a lot of employees that they can rely upon who need that work, and they control a lot of legislation. L3 Communications, $15 billion, 61,000 employees. Finmeccanica, $24 billion, 70,000 employees. They're in the military vehicles and missiles and small arms and ammunition. EADS, EADS, $68 billion in sales, and they employ 133,120 people. They're in missiles, Electronics and Aircraft, Northrop Grumman, 26.4 billion, 72,500 employees. Raytheon, 24.9 billion, 71,000 employees. They're in missiles. Remember, every missile that you see that's being fired, every bullet that's shot, every aircraft that carrier that is out there, someone's making it, and these are the people who keep saying, we don't have enough, we need more. General Dynamics, 32 billion, 95,100 employees. They're into artillery, military vehicles, small arms and ammunition, and ships. And they had just alone, just one company, General Dynamics, 18,000 transactions. And that's who gives you those transactions? Lobbyists. And who are behind, who control the lobbyists? The special consultants, and frequently these people hire current or former legislators or people in the Pentagon or the National Security Agency. BAE Systems, $30 billion, 93,500 employees. Boeing, $68 billion in profits, 171,700. They're the largest. They're in air electronics, missiles, space, and aircraft. And then the largest is Lockheed Martin, and $46 billion, 123,000, but they're the most powerful. So these are the people who are really behind the scenes that you'll never hear about, very powerful people. To address another issue that doesn't get discussed at all, but I want to discuss it for a few moments, and that is, why is it every time there's a shooting, especially in a school, or where it seems that a person working in a place or studying in a place went nuts and killed people, it's always about the guns, but never about the meds. Here's some actual statistics. Everything is completely footnoted. I'll give you some examples of school shootings, and more specifically what the person was on. In Illinois, 6 dead, 15 wounded. He was on Prozac, he was withdrawing. School shooting, Prozac antidepressant. In Minnesota, 10 dead. School shooting, he was on Paxil. And in Pennsylvania, shooting, Zoloft. In Alabama, shooting, Zoloft again in South Carolina. Multiple medications for depression in Germany. Same in France. Also, medical withdrawal on psychiatric medications in Texas, and 18-year-old plots a Columbine school attack, and then Luvox and Zoloft, a school shooting in Colorado. That's Columbine, 15 dead, and antidepressants, getting off of them in Japan, 8 dead, Prozac antidepressant. These are all school shootings in Oregon, 4 dead, school shooting on multiple medications for depression. In Washington State, stabbing and killed several people. Antidepressants in Colorado. Man assaults girl, kills himself and her. Meds for depression in Pennsylvania. Killings, Luvox in Florida. Man commits murder during clinical trial with Luvox. And psychotic medication in New York City. Man with a gun goes in school, holds principal hostage, antidepressants, school shooting, Texas, SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors in Finland, kills 9 students. Again in New Jersey, school shooting, over-medicated, antidepressants in Virginia, again in Virginia, Zoloft in Australia. All these were people went in, 33 dead at Virginia Tech. That guy was on antidepressants. Did you hear a thing about that? No, you heard about the 33 dead. That's unfortunate. You heard about the guns. You did not hear about the fact that these people were on antidepressants. Now, I'm sitting here in my hand from Wellbutrin and Lexapro in Arkansas and school shootings. I've got them in Massachusetts, Indiana, Mississippi, Finland, New York, Washington, Wisconsin, Tennessee, Idaho, Washington, North Carolina, all school shootings, all on Paxil, Effexor, Zoloft. I have 5 pages to show over 90% of all mass murderers have been on psychiatric meds And why haven't we even had the courage to have an open and honest discussion about, A, do they need these meds? When I was going to school, not a single kid was on meds, period. And I went to the largest high school in the state, Parkersburg High School, with 5,000 students. No one committed suicide. No one killed anyone else. No one was on meds. Now kids are on meds. Tomorrow I'll talk about how Big Pharma and the psychiatric establishment drugged up our kids and why we have to start examining this, being honest about it, and not ideologically siding, but look at the truth and look at the facts. We are an over-medicated society. We've allowed our children to become hostages to the pharmaceutical companies. We've allowed the psychiatrists who know nothing about what goes on in a kid's body when they give him these drugs. And I'll also show you tomorrow where the father of modern psychiatry went on the record recently, and you didn't hear about it, and said that there is no study to show anywhere that any of these medical diagnoses are correct. There's no objective study. None. There's no way that a person walks into your office and say, I'm suffering from depression. You can actually prove they're depressed. There's no brain chemical imbalance. So we'll deal with that. And finally, before we take a break, I believe that we can change. I know we can. I've seen a lot of people in my own life who people had kind of given up on them ever being better people, ended up becoming better people. How is that possible? Well, there are several things we can learn from science, but also from maybe our grandparents. Maybe the lessons they wanted to teach us, we did learn, and then we decided we're no longer important. So we put a lot of our old considerations of what built character and moral and of spiritual value, maybe we just put it in a mothball bag and put it in the closet someplace because it didn't go with who we're supposed to be today. So what can we do to be a better human being and as a result, a healthier, happier human being? First and foremost, there's a personal cost to callousness. University of North Carolina did a study published in Psychological Sciences, and according to an important report, it should give us a chance to think about when we walk past that homeless person and we decide, I don't need to help them. When we know that there are legitimate charities that are out there helping people, there are a lot of good people in this world who are each day trying to make it a better world at some level for people who have less. When we make ourselves indifferent, when we wake up each day feeling I don't need to contribute to anything, I don't need to contribute my time or do anything, I'm just after me today. Well, that's callousness, and you pay a deep price for that. Quote, feeling less committed to moral principles. Let me repeat that. When you become callous, when you become jaded, when you're so selfish, you only can think about yourself. When you try to justify, well, I was hurt, I'm in pain, well, I was used, I was abused, and we know there's a whole brigade of, there's legions of Americans who walk around each day going over and say, I see your merit badge for you're a victim. I'm a victim. We're all victims. And no, that doesn't work. All you do then is you feel less committed to moral principles. And when you don't have moral principles, you're not going to do the moral thing in life. Also, the high status brings low ethics. Boy, is this important. I've counseled tens of thousands of people. I've counseled over 3,000 very famous people and celebrities. If you think that money, possessions, class, standing gives you a moral imperative to feel and be better, the higher your status, in point of fact, just the opposite, the lower your ethics. You are poorer in morality, and all the studies show that. In fact, in a series of 7 studies published in PNSAS, the researchers found that upper-class people are more likely than lower-class people to break all kinds of rules. They believe that because of their power and celebrity and position, that they have a right to something that the rest don't. They don't want to wait in line. They're impatient. They always want everything, and they want it now. And by the way, happiness is about respect, not riches. If you think money buys you happiness, show me someone who's bought happiness. I'd like to meet that person because I haven't seen that. Kindness is its own reward. They even found this in toddlers. In fact, according to the study, several studies over the past 6 years have found that kids as young as 18 months old will spontaneously help people in need. But do they do that just to please adults? No. Nope. They don't. Researchers have published evidence that their kindness is motivated by deep, perhaps innate, feelings of compassion for others. So, that's important. Never give up on being kind. Also, we can train ourselves to be more compassionate if we haven't been. Gratitude sustains relationships even through tough times. You really don't know who you should have in your life until you're at a point where you seem not to have a good life. When you're in crisis, that's when you find out who really is there for you and who is just there for the good times or whatever they can get. But gratitude is crucial. It's a foundational for all relationships. Remember, it is part of our nature to cooperate rather than to compete, yet we live in a society that only teaches us competition. So be kind, cooperate, work together. Just some advice I think we could all learn from. Now, I have my own views, of course, on I do not take sides of Republican, Democrat, liberal. I believe in spiritual, progressive values, meaning be moral and ethical and honest, compassionate to all people, segregate no one, and look at everything as sacred. Unless someone says, I'm not sacred, and here's why, and they do something that doesn't show their sacredness, always start with the idea that you have more in common with someone than your artificial conditioning self would allow you to believe. And I just, especially at a time when Donald Trump represents so much that is so wrong with the world, and we're now saying, this is what's wrong with America. It wouldn't matter whether it's Hillary Clinton or another round of Barack Obama or Bill Clinton or George Bush or Ronald Reagan. These are all wrong people. They're all sociopath, in my opinion. They're all dysfunctional. They're all narcissists. They're all self-absorbed. Don't confuse the slickness and the smoothness of some of their personalities and their erudite nature versus some who are coarse and crude. We have become a nation that is a model of dysfunction. And according to Chris Hedges, the what is it now? Let's go back. Four-decade-long assault on our democratic institutions. Who buy? By corporations. And the results have they've left us weak and largely dysfunctional. Now, these institutions, which surrendered their efficacy and credibility to serve corporate interest, should have been a firewall. Instead, they're tottering under the onslaught. Who am I referring to? Labor unions are a spent force. The press is corporatized and distrusted. Universities have been purged of dissidents and independent scholars who criticize neoliberalism, decried the decay of democratic institutions and political parties. Public broadcasting and the arts have been defunded and left on life support. The courts have been stacked with judges whose legal careers were spent serving corporate power, a trend in appointments that continued under Barack Obama. Money has replaced the vote, which is how someone as unqualified as Bessie DeVos can buy herself a cabinet seat in the Democratic Party rather than sever its ties to Wall Street and corporations, is naively waiting in the wings to profit from a Trump debacle. Now, according to Ralph Nader, if you remember, Ralph Nader is a part of a small group started by Gerald Salante, myself, Robert Thurman of Columbia University, Ralph Nader. We believe that we can do a lot through occupying prosperity and peace. And Nader said this to Chris Hedges, quote, "The biggest asset Trump has is the decadent, clueless, narcissistic, corporate indentured, warmongering Democratic Party." He said, "If the Democratic strategy is waiting for Godot, waiting for Trump to implode, we are in trouble." And just about everything you say about the Democrats, you can say about the AFL-CIO. They don't control the train, end quote. The loss of credibility by Democratic institutions has thrust the country into an existential as well as economic crisis. The courts, the universities, and the press are no longer trusted by tens of millions of Americans who correctly see them as organs of the corporate elites. These institutions are traditionally the mechanisms by which a society is able to unmask the lies of the powerful and critique ruling ideologies and promote justice. And because Americans have been bitterly betrayed by their institutions, the Trump regime can attack the press as the opposition party, threatening to cut off university funding and taunt a federal jurist as a so-called judge and denounce a court order as outrageous. Well, the decay of democratic institutions is the prerequisite for the rise of authoritarianism or fascist regimes. And this decay is giving credibility to a pathological liar. The Trump administration, according to an Emerson College poll, is considered by 49% of registered voters to be truthful, while the media are considered truthful by only 39% of registered voters. Once American democratic institutions no longer function, reality becomes whatever absurdity the White House issues. And most of the rules of democracy are underwritten. These rules determine public comportment and ensure respect for democratic norms and procedures and institutions. And President Trump has, to the delight of his supporters, rejected this political and cultural etiquette. It was Hannah Arendt in The Origins of Totalitarianism noted that when democratic institutions collapse, it is, quote, easier to accept patently absurd propositions than the old truths, which have become banalities. So the chatter of the liberal ruling elites about our democracy is itself an absurdity. Vulgarity with its cynical dismal of a dismissal of respected standards and accepted theories, Hannah wrote, infects political discourse. This vulgarity is mistaken for courage and a new style of thinking. And by the way, Nader said he does not think the Republican Party will turn against Trump or even consider impeachment unless his presidency appears to threaten its chances of retaining power in the 2018 elections. Nader said the Democratic Party is just too decadent and too incompetent to mount a serious challenge to Trump. So what then do we do? Well, I have several ideas, and I'll be sharing those over the next month about what we can do to take back America. What we can do to show that we, the people, have our own ideas, including of proper governance and bring it down to where we are in more control. But one more reason that we should be very concerned about those in power is what those who were supposed to be there for peace did. I'm going to get to that in a moment. But I want to have you listen to what one Syrian woman tells the truth about foreign-backed rebels. Remember how everyone, CNN and McCain and Barack Obama, everyone said that, yes, we're funding these Syrian soldiers because they're going to oust this tyrannical Assad. Well, those were all lies, yet the American media has not acknowledged those lies. Here's a Syrian woman who does.
I think this whole debate is ignoring the main point here, which is that the rebel uprising or the democratic uprising is not that. It's a Muslim Brotherhood uprising. The Muslim Brotherhood was the main opposition group in Syria for the last 40 years, and they are the ones that want to remove the secular government. Yes. And I'm not a government supporter, I'm for the reform process, just like the majority of the Syrian people. But the fact is, the fact is, it is the American and NATO governments and Israel that are funding these Al-Qaeda terrorists and Muslim Brotherhood extremists. And that is the point that everybody here is missing.
That's true.
And the fact is that, excuse me, sir, but you do have a stake in Syria because we have Russia emerging as a superpower and you have China emerging as a superpower and you want, and America and NATO want to control the Mediterranean Sea. They want to cut off this new pipeline deal that is happening between Syria, Iraq, and Iran. They want to cut off ties between Syria and Iran, which is why these people hate Iran so much. And this is why these sectarians are against any unity between Syria and Iran, because they want to see Syria get destroyed. And that is what this is about, destroying Syria.
Mimi, what sort of government do you want?
Of course, I would like to see a government that has less corruption, but also maintains our foreign policy, which is of the utmost importance, because we have an imperialist Zionist entity right next door to us, Israel, which is funded by NATO, and the whole crisis is being created by our enemies, Israel, NATO, America.
Okay, can I just ask you?
All right, that was a debate, and that was the person standing up, and she's not pro-Assad, but she's telling the truth. Unfortunately, this is a truth that 99% of the American public will never hear. In a few moments, I'll tell you the truth about what Nikki Haley, our ambassador to the UN, and our government does not want you to know about Ukraine and Crimea and its annexation. But first, I want to share something about how false allegations of rape are used to lynch African-American refugees and Palestinians. This is a story you haven't heard anywhere else.
Welcome to the Real News Network in Baltimore. I'm Kim Brown. Is rape used as a political tool in Israel to demonize and dehumanize Arabs and Palestinians? Last June, the Israeli public was shocked to hear of a girl with a mental disability who was reportedly raped by a Palestinian as an act of nationalistic violence. The girl has eventually confessed that her family pressured her to invent the rape in order to have a Palestinian boy arrested. In December, the Israeli Committee for Women's Rights held a debate on sexual offenses in joint Jewish-Arab communities. Now, the debate quickly deteriorated into incitement against Arabs. In a recent piece in Electronic Intifada, David Sheen reported that among the political parties who organized the debate is the Shaz Party, which is described as a very religious Jewish political party there. A senior member of the party, Amnon Cohen, has been arrested and was recently accused of receiving bribery in the form of sexual favors. A woman testified that she was afraid for her life if she refused to have sex with the former member of the Israeli parliament. And today we're joined with the author of the article, David Sheen. David is an independent journalist and a filmmaker, originally from Toronto, now living and reporting from the ground in Dimona, Israel. David has written for numerous publications, and he regularly speaks on U.S. college campuses and in European parliaments about his work, which focuses on racial tensions and religious extremism in Israeli society. And David's joining us today from Israel. David, welcome to The Real News.
Thank you for having me.
So, David, if you could describe for us, what is the culture of rape in general, and what does it mean in Israel?
Well, rape culture is a problem everywhere in the world that I know of, the places that I've lived and visited, where patriarchy, misogyny, where men control society and view women and their bodies as fair game, as essentially an extension of their own property. And this permeates culture. And it's a problem in North America, and it's a problem here in Israel. Now, unfortunately, what we see is that in Israel, instead of the government saying this is a major problem, we need to work at reducing the amount of misogyny and the amount of rape culture and incidences of sexual harassment and sex crimes. Instead, what we have is top members of the government committing these crimes, top members of law enforcement, top members of the judiciary, top members of regional councils, and people in society like university deans and the head of the largest bank in Israel, the president of Israel, on rape charges. So we see that throughout the top levels of society, there's serious sex crimes, and that sends a message to the rest of society. Well, you know, this is a normal way to act, and sadly, the only time it ever gets mentioned by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is if he thinks he can somehow blame rape on non-Jewish, non-white non-Jewish people, specifically Palestinians and African refugees and other non-Jewish folk in the country.
So given the fact that, as you said, rape is prevalent throughout the globe and doesn't necessarily tend to be exclusive to one particular society or the other, but the issue with rape is that it is often underreported. So to your knowledge, what kind of data exists about the prevalence of sexual violence motivated by nationalism?
Well, this was the topic of the discussion in the Knesset in December. And essentially, members of the Knesset were stating, we have proof. In fact, there's a plague of Palestinian citizens of Israel, Arab men, who sexually harass and sexually assault women. Police representatives, representative of the Israeli police force, which by no means are suspect of being pro-Arab, but they were sitting no evidence of this. You know, we talked to all our local police forces and they reported back to us that they see no incidents. In fact, the level of sexual assaults in those mixed cities where you have both Jewish and Palestinian populations, the amount of sex assaults there is actually going down. That includes sex assaults in general and sex assaults committed by non-Jews. That was the police statement. And as I wrote in the article, the same thing happened 5 years ago, the last time that the right wing tried once again to convene a Knesset session to blame non-Jews. Police said, no, I'm sorry, we don't have any evidence of some kind of, you know, concerted attack by Palestinian people specifically trying to attack Jewish women as a way to get revenge or to, you know, harm Jewish people, the weakest link, you know, women who are easy prey for sexual evidence of any of this. It's in the minds of racist lawmakers. And I don't mind also saying there are many groups in society who their ostensive reason to exist is to prevent Jews and non-Jews from being in romantic relationships. I know, you know, you had the film called Loving that came out in the United States just a few months ago about the Supreme Court Loving versus Virginia, how a white man and a black woman were not allowed to wed just a few decades ago in the United States. There had to be a Supreme Court decision to overrule that. It should be pointed out that in Israel, there till this day in 2017, there's no way for Jewish people and non-Jewish people to marry in the country. So the incidences of Jews and non-Jews deciding to live their lives together is relatively rare to begin with. But even those few rare instances, they make racists so angry groups to patrol streets and in Israel and beaches and public places, and they get funds from the government to actively try to prevent romantic relationships between Jews and non-Jews. And these groups are the ones who, you know, put this idea out there that, oh, the only kinds of, the kinds of relationships are abusive, and therefore we're not, you know, we're trying to prevent these relationships from happening because we're trying to prevent abuse. But the ultimate reason is they want to prevent miscegenation. They've got a eugenics objective to have ethnic purity, and this is what they openly state. And sadly, they receive government funds to try to make this manifest.
So talk about the accusations against refugees from Africa who are also blamed for sexually assaulting Jewish women. How much validity should be given, or credence should be given, to these accusations? Because they sound like they could be somewhat politically motivated.
I mean, sure. Look, there's no question that no one is going to claim that the crime rate of any group in society is zero. Yes, there are rape crimes committed by Jews, non-Jews, Arabs, Africans, and that's going to be the case regardless. But police themselves will say that refugees have a lower crime rate per capita than native-born Israelis. So why then is the focus on non-white, non-Jewish folk? Well, again, it's a way to incite racism. And this is what we have seen for the last several years in Israeli society. And the way that this has become a factor, just look a couple months ago in the city of Petah Tikva. It's a suburb of Tel Aviv. And the incitement is so great against refugees and associating them with sex crimes, baselessly, I might add, that now we can have an Emmett Till-like situation where a refugee was walking down the street right outside of City Hall, and he walked past a group. And the reason why we know the details is because since it's outside City Hall, there are cameras situated there. And so we saw CCTV footage of what actually happened. So old black man just walking down the street, he sees three girls, three teenage women standing there. And, you know, they're, I don't know, 3 feet, maybe 5-6 feet away from him. And he says something to them, you can't tell, but whatever. It's over in 10 seconds, he walks away. Words are exchanged for 10 seconds, and the man walks away. Within seconds, he's pounced upon by a group of young Jewish men, and they beat him for over an hour in front of City Hall. And it got to the point where they pummeled him to death and to the point where he was unrecognizable. And the only way that his brother was able to recognize him is because years ago when he fled the fighting in Darfur, he was maimed and he lost several fingers. And because that was the only way that his brother was able to recognize him, because his face was, you know, irrecognizable. So on the pure, you know, the accusation that a non-white, non-Jewish man spoke to some non-Jewish girls, that was enough to set off a lynch. That's where, and since that time, the mayor of that city, instead of saying, wow, we got to stop this racism, just the opposite. Instead, he's rounded up African refugees in the city, and he's shut the electricity off to their apartments to banish them from the city. This is part and parcel of the way that Israeli society, but it does speak to the greater phenomenon of also, you know, insinuating that non-Jews are sex criminals and they should be treated as such.
And David, in the piece that you wrote about this, you write about the, quote, sex crime epidemic in Israel. So why does Israel have such a high rate of sexual violence, in your opinion?
Well, it's always difficult to actually measure sexual violence because, as many people have said, so much of it is unreported. So is it rising? Is it falling? Are just people talking about it more? Are they aware of it more? One thing is clear, and that the attitudes around sexual violence are very problematic. Something like 61% of Israeli men do not think that raping someone who is an acquaintance is rape. Somehow they conceive of rape as only being a situation, I guess, where you're hiding behind a bush and you jump out at some, you know, complete stranger and physically assault them. They only conceive of that as rape. The idea that someone you've met a couple once or twice and then you socialize with them and then rape them, that they don't think of that as rape, which is, of course, it's ridiculous. It's rape in every single way. But that really speaks to the overarching problem of how sexual violence is categorized and even understood and acknowledged in society. So that being the case, the message has to come from up top. But when you have Benjamin Netanyahu himself working in an office that's full of sex criminals, when you have multiple...
That's part one. Part two will be tomorrow. I believe that this type of insight information is necessary because you cannot get this in the mainstream or the alternative media. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.